Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's Wanderlust, Essaying Forth with Jeff Dyer and Odni Iyer. I'm Ethan Nosowski. I'm your moderator this afternoon. I'm the editorial director at Grey Wolf Press, and it's really a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank our sponsors this afternoon. Thanks to the Barbara Osher Pro Suecia Foundation and the Icelandic Literature Center for helping to sponsor this particular event. I will do the silence your cell phone reminder. There will be a book signing afterwards today, right here, I think, so it should be pretty easy to find. I know Jeff has to run out after his panel tomorrow, so for anybody who was hoping to get a book signed tomorrow and not today, this is your moment to get a Jeff Dyer signed book, so grab him. It's a great kind of pleasure for me to be with both of these authors in slightly different situations, which is that I've known Jeff for about 20 years now and worked on several of his books over the years. And I don't know if we've ever actually been on stage before. I know I've interviewed you, but I don't think we've been on stage together before.
Maybe not.
Yeah, I think not. So there's a new adventure for me there, but it's also a new adventure because I was able to read this new book by a writer I'd never read before for this panel, Odni Iyer, whose Land of Love and Ruins we'll be talking about today. Let me tell you who you've got up here briefly, and then we'll kind of jump into it. And I will read her bio, so you know. Odni Iyer, Iversdotter, I'm going to butcher that. Was that perfect. Close enough?
Yeah,
perfect for an American. Was born in 1972. She completed a doctoral minor degree at Paris Sorbonne University, as well as carrying out research in Icelandic museum field studies. She's written three autobiographical novels, and interestingly, in this sort of Wanderlust Essaying Forth panel, I love that we've gotten advanced enough as a culture where we can bring a novel into a panel called Essaying Forth. She's translated and edited literary works, organized visual arts events, and ran a visual arts space in New York and Reykjavik. She's also worked as an editor of the environmental website Natura Info. Land of Love and Ruins, this book, was nominated for the Icelandic Literary Award in 2011 and won the Icelandic Women's Literature Prize in 2012. This book comes with one of these rare rock and roll blurbs, which I rather like, from Björk, whose albums Biophilia and Vulnikura, Odni has helped, co-wrote some of the lyrics. Björk says, Odni Iyer is an authentic author, philosopher, and mystic. She weaves together diaries and fiction. She is the writer I feel can best express the female psyche of now and has bridged the gap between rural Iceland and Western philosophy. I know that the celebrity blurbs really work. Jeff Dyer is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Jeff Dyer has received the Somerset Maugham Award, the E.M. Forster Award, a Lannan Literary Fellowship, a National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism, and in 2015, the Wyndham Campbell Prize for Nonfiction. Shabby resume. The author of four novels and nine works of nonfiction, Dyer is writer in residence at the University of Southern California and lives in Los Angeles. His books have been translated into 24 languages, and not to be outdone on the celebrity blurb front, I see that in tomorrow's New York Times, the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar calls But Beautiful, a book about jazz, one of Jeff's earlier books, has become one of his favorite books. I just was reading that in the by the book interview in the New York Times tomorrow. So really, we've got celebrity endorsements for everybody up here today, except for me. So if there are any celebrities in the crowd who want to endorse me afterwards, that's fine, I'll be ready. This panel day is called Wanderlust, which is a feeling familiar now to many Americans who would like to wander forth and these days. But both these books, in odd ways, take on ideas of pilgrimage. I think in Jeff's series of travel pieces that make up White Sands, his most recent book, Each one is a kind of a pilgrimage, a sort of secular pilgrimage, I'd say. And Oddný's book is a little bit more home-based in Iceland, but includes a lot of wandering around the country and then sometimes outside of the country, and the theme of home and what makes a home and what it means to be both restless and rooted is at the heart, I think, of her really interesting novel. But what I liked about these books too, and putting these two authors together, is there's a bit of an X here where each of these authors travels to the other's place rather unwittingly, I think. So there's the longest sort of piece of travel writing in Oddný's book takes place to the Lake District in England, where she's obsessed with the Romantic poets. And Jeff has a little bit where he travels to the Northern Lights, but although in Norway, not in Iceland, but actually the Northern Lights does come up in the Land of Love and Ruins too. And what I'm interested in this is this idea of pilgrimage and how it can be used to structure a story or a narrative or a drive within the author. And so, and I thought, just to give you a flavor of these two books, that we'd have them read just little bits from each of those sections. And I thought it'd be funny just to have each one of them comment essentially on the other's area or geography or landscape, landscape being an important organizing force in these books too. So maybe we could start with Oddný, if you could read a little bit from your, from Lake, they have, I want to talk a little bit afterwards about secular pilgrimage, which I think these books kind of treat. Do you want to read first?
Yes.
Yeah, great.
I'm like full-time changing my classes. So.
So in your part-time job, maybe we can read a little.
Yeah. And talking about travel, I must say that I very much enjoy being in Berkeley, and we had a wonderful tour yesterday around the campus, and I was really like getting into a state of mania a little bit, like it was so wonderful. Like 40 libraries, he said. This is one of the diary entries that take place in Cumbria. And I just start somewhere where I'm like, ice and snow, lightning, umbilical cords and animals. And a little sign stated that William Wordsworth, had planted yew trees and daffodils in the churchyard with the help of his sister Dorothy in remembrance of the children who had died and the children who were never born. I went into the churchyard and saw the graves of these siblings and the dark green trees. I think that they were the most beautiful trees I'd ever seen. I didn't have a pen with me and repeated the name so as not to forget it. Yew tree, yew tree, yew tree. Continued on and into Grasmere village, where proudly sauntering jackdaws welcomed me, and I said hi-ho and knew that I was back on track. And yes, indeed, it was the village of the two siblings. I was on cloud nine, having arrived at the roots of romanticism. So it was a shock to walk around the village, peek into the shop windows, and see all the pillows embroidered with rotten daffodils and various other things related to the story of the Lake District poets. It's one thing to remember, another to get stuck. Why don't people buy notepads and write poems instead of sit around on historical poem pillows watching TV? Why not renew romanticism, re-clarify the relationship between creation and memory? Well, I myself have come here pretty much like a dog sniffing out monuments, excited about the memorabilia, the locks of hair that the poet sent with his letters, the candles that he himself made from the sheep tallow and used for writing. He hadn't wanted to write at a regular desk, but instead used a lap desk, which I had a good long look at, among other things. Maybe it's just a question of aesthetics. If we cross some indefinable and subtle line in the reconstruction and exaltation of the past, we feel as if aesthetics and beauty are stagnating. Which must be a contradiction in itself, stagnant beauty, standardized beauty. Surely beauty must be in motion, or B motion. My guidebook on this trip of mine is the journal of Dorothy Wordsworth, the sister of the famous romantic poet William Wordsworth. I came across this book on the electric stage and fell into it. It's incredibly exciting, even though it's not really about anything. And yet it's about so much. For example, you get to know whether her brother slept well or badly on this or that day, whether he sat writing late into the night or not. After reading it, I felt I had to come here and see the siblings' house, find out about their life together, discover whether the dwelling they shared might reveal something of the closeness of their relationship, if I could learn from it. I'm going to find Dove Cottage. Dorothy describes the great amount of time she spent with her brother in the orchard there, where they lived together after having been orphaned and separated for many years. In this orchard, William rewrote his poems and she read them over and amended them and then wrote in her diary or perhaps composed some poems of her own which have not survived. Sometimes he laid his hand on her shoulder as she read, as he describes it, and judging by his poems, the trust between them was perfect.
Maybe we can just pause there. Yeah. Thank you. And it's worth pointing out, of course, that that Audney has just read words that she didn't precisely write, because this is a translated book. So often reading from your own book is an act of discovery, perhaps, and a pilgrimage of its own sort from one language to another. But I'm curious here, and you know, I just want to pause for a moment and talk about this section of this book. This is a book largely, it's an autobiography. I want to preserve the distinction for the moment between yourself as the author and the character who is describing that journey, but it's largely about a narrator who is at least very much based on your own life and who is struggling in some ways to find your place within the home that you grew up. And I'm curious, this section, which is, I don't know, it's not a huge chunk of the book, it's about 10 pages maybe, what did leaving your home accomplish? What did this kind of both maybe formally within the book, what did it accomplish for you, but also what did this journey accomplish as you were trying to get to know your home better? Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Or why did you feel you need to make that trip and put it, I guess, in this book, which is largely about Iceland in the wake of a kind of financial or by banking crisis?
Yeah, it's like based in a period of crisis where I saw it, I knew, and I understood that because it was a financial crisis. Many politicians had the idea of solve it with destroying the nature. So that was their answer. And
to solve the crisis by destroying nature, meaning? How
yeah, like to make bigger industries and, take all the waterfalls away and destroy the wasteland and so on, because to make it into something like money.
Oh, this sounds like a great idea. We only have that inspiration here.
Yeah. So I was thinking, yeah, there is something like, even though you are so speechless, when somebody has those great ideas, you really try to convince them that's not a good idea. And for example, when you say it is very good to have like a wasteland, it's good to have it there, and then they say, but do you ever go there? Well, I go there, but I'm not always inside the like middle of nowhere, but I do not live there. No, nobody wants to live there, they say. No, but that's also, it's good to have it. It's so important to know about it, that it is there. You don't have to stay there. So, you know, I was in this battle to try to find very intelligible answers. And so I needed also to, so I believed in the way, you know, go and touch the earth here and there, like in Iceland, but also abroad, and understand something about, so I believe really that the earth keeps our emotions, and it's like a huge archive of our emotional story.
Great, that's lovely, thank you. I want to move on to Jeff's book for a bit. I mean, in a way, the pilgrimage in this book, there are several kind of smaller pilgrimages within Audney's book. Jeff's is a series of pilgrimages that essentially structure this book of travel narratives. And so in a way, almost any of these pieces could work for our purposes, but maybe Jeff, you could read just a bit of The Northern Lights so we can see each panelist's home areas through, or landscapes through the other's eyes.
Yeah, sure thing. Can you hear okay?
No.
Oh. Is that better? Okay.
So Jeff, just lean forward awkwardly and uncomfortably a little bit. That'd
okay.
be great.
We don't want to get feedback though. How's that? Okay, great. So just a few quick words. This is about a trip we made to Norway, to the Arctic Circle. My wife whose name is Rebecca, is given the fictional name Jessica here. And I'm afraid you're going to miss out on a rather brilliant joke. One of the guides on this dog sledding trip we did in the middle of the 24-hour darkness of the Arctic Circle in January, she's introduced to us, and her name is Yeti. And I respond really very wittily. I say, Yeti, what an abominable name. And that, to say the least, doesn't endear us to our guides as we go off on this dog sledding trip in really, incredibly cold conditions, and it's very dark. But I should say also there's going to be a chance for a bit of audience participation during the call and response section of this, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. Eventually, we were saddled up and ready to go. Whenever we hire a car, Jessica always steers us out of the parking lot for the first few tentative miles when we're unsure of the controls and the chances of an accident are high. On this occasion, though, I was driving the dog sled. I said that she should take the reins, but she insisted that this was my manly prerogative and plonked herself down in the sled on a comfy-looking piece of blue rug. A few moments later, we were off. Geez, the Huskies meant business. There was no doubt about that. I still had the sled's brake anchor in my hand, was struggling to hook it to the side of the sled so that it would not impale Jessica's head like a fishing hook in the cheek of a big human fish. A quite extraordinary amount of speed had been abruptly unleashed, unharnessed by even a modicum of control. We were charging downhill at an angle, so we had to lean into the slope to avoid capsizing. Through my hood, I could still hear the dogs yelping, though by now my head was so full of yelping, this might have been the residue of the old yelping of dogs in the compound, not the ecstatic yelping of huskies galloping through the Arctic dark. It was hard work steering the sled, hard enough to make me sweat. It felt good being hot, but sweating was not good at all, because as soon as this exertion was over, the sweat would freeze. We were zooming along, plunging down a slope. I lost control of the sled, over which I'd never had the slightest control, and tumbled off the back into deep snow. The sled spilled over, but the anchor had not been deployed, and the huskies did not stop. They had not been released from captivity in order to have their outing curtailed at this early stage. Even through my hood, I could hear Jessica yelling, "Stop!" But she was dragged for 50 meters, tangled up beneath the sled, and for all I knew, had the anchor embedded in her skull. As I ran after her, with no thought in my head except for her welfare, I was silently forming the words, "I said you should have driven first." It took ages to get the attention of the other teams because they had zoomed off even faster than we had. But eventually, Birgitta and Yeti came back and pulled the sled off Jessica. She was uninjured but sufficiently shaken up to declare that she did not want to go on with the expedition. We were all standing with our breath creating little snowstorms in the light of our headlamps, busy disentangling all the reins and dogs which had got into the most incredible tangle. I say we, but I just stood there really, doing nothing, sweating and breathing heavily, worried that if I exerted myself further, I would end up entombed like the Frankenstein monster in a glacier of frozen sweat. Actually, I did try to do something. I tried to take pictures of what I referred to as the crash site, but my camera had frozen. Everything about this environment was quite unsuited to photography, human habitation, tourism, or happiness. Jessica had had enough too and was persuaded to continue only on condition that she was driven by Yeti or Birgitta and not by that idiot. She's in shock, I said. She doesn't know what she's saying. I had no desire to drive either, and so we both ended up as passengers, each on a sled driven by one of the guides. We made much better progress like this, and it was quite fun barreling through the barren wastes. Oh, and I had come to love the Huskies. Irrespective of what the job entails, I love anyone, man or beast, who does their jobs well, and these Huskies whose job was to pull a sled were absolute in their huskiness. From reading about Amundsen's expedition to the South Pole, I knew that if the going got tough, the Huskies could be fed to each other. Yeti kept up a lovely sing-song of instruction and encouragement, which, for all I knew, constantly reminded the dogs of this fact, that the weak would become food for the less weak. So has it always been, so will it always be. Since she was singing, I started singing too. One of the cadence songs from Full Metal Jacket. I don't know, but I've been told, Eskimo pussy is mighty cold. And then I thought of the film Atanagarat, The Fast Runner, which among its many other virtues hotly refutes this claim. My mind was wandering, but it kept coming back to the immediate reality, which was that we were out in the open air, in pitch darkness. The brief period when a glimmer of dark light appeared on the horizon had already come to an end, was no more than a memory now, and we were out here in freezing conditions, and the northern lights were, of course, nowhere to be seen. Thank you.
Thank you. You all were so rude to be laughing at this in the search for the sublime. I mean, but actually, the laughter is no small part of it, right? I mean, there's an interesting kind of tension, and I think a lot of the essays in this book of Jeff's, but in a lot of his work generally, between this use of humor and the inevitable disappointment that comes with the search for peak experiences. Jeff, could you kind of talk about how disappointment seems tied to pilgrimage a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, for example, of that, you know, Philip Larkin used to go on these unbelievably miserable holidays to other parts of Britain with his mum, you know, when he was well into his own sort of middle age, really. And in one of his great grumpy letters, you know, he says the holiday is very obviously a descendant of the, you know, old-fashioned idea of pilgrimage, in that we go on these holidays to make some sort of penance for being relatively contented in our normal everyday lives. That's his particular take on it. But actually, I think it relates quite nicely to this romantic idea of the peak experience. And, you know, let's not forget that in book whichever it is of the Prelude, Crossing the Alps, you know, which is going
to be... Bringing it back to Wordsworth.
And, you know, crossing the Alps is going to be the apotheosis of the kind of romantic experience. And you remember it happens without Wordsworth being conscious of it. And then only so subsequently realize, oh yeah, we've actually crossed the Alps. So it's not exactly a disappointing experience, but what was literally meant to be a peak experience passed without his being aware of it. I think also for those of us who are the kind of progeny of the Romantics, who have this longing, really, for transcendence, or whatever you might want to call it, it sets you up almost inevitably for, occasional disappointments. The nice and reassuring thing, from my point of view, is that history of disappointment, and I should say that being English, I shouldn't boast, but I'm far better qualified than any of you Americans to talk about disappointment, simply by virtue of the fact of being British. I think it, in spite of that long history of disappointment, it in no ways diminishes one's expectation and hopes for the next peak experience, I think.
And was that, and Odni, was that true for your Lake District visit? My recollection was that you didn't find what you were looking for there.
Well, I found something there. Yeah. But then I went to the...
A cushion with a little prelude on it.
Yeah. There I was overcritical, like, you know, this angry and critical. But then, of course, I admitted I was on the same track. And I was... I had this peak experience sitting in a garden. Like, I was obsessed by the ivy, because there is always, like, a herb that is, like... I'm obsessed with some kind of herbs writing a book. So I'm just waiting, which herb is it now, or herb, or vegetation? Like, and for this one, it was the ivy. So I saw it everywhere. And when I was sitting there, and there were ivies all over, and I saw the little cave where they had been sitting. Yeah, I had this peak. But then I wanted more. So I went into the next house, which was also a museum. And there I had, like, this disappointment, and there was nothing in the air, no spirit, and so. But I was brought up by my parents. They wanted us to learn to be traveling in a boring way. Mm-hmm. So they were, like, really anti, you know, what's called peak. There was no peak. Like, my father, he wanted always to see a glacier or a big waterfall. Like, he was into the peaking and getting the jeep very stuck, and they would start fighting and, you know, getting the emotional. But my mother, she was working in the other direction. So this was my father's way, and my mother, she's an artist, and she would, like, just... you know, go into the slow and look at something very not important. And so we learned, I think we learned that also, just to somehow drift and wander.
Well, there's... Could I say two more things about the Lake District and disappointment?
Is that okay if he says one?
Yeah.
So go ahead, John.
The Canadian writer Kate Pullinger visits the Lake District, and she sort of, just the name is enough to disappoint her. She comes from a country where there are, I think it's fair to say, quite sizable lakes. And she's struck by the way that there's, you know, in sort of towns now, you might have an area designated the entertainment district, you know. And she said the idea of a lake district, that they could all be contained in this one distinct area, was itself a sign of how diminished the experience was going to be. And then to go back to this English thing, you know, although I was making a sort of joke, I really feel that there is something in your American psyches which isn't so disappointed. And I was just remembering the other day something when my dad was involved in some sort of retail thing, and he was wanting to get some sort of refund or something, and it didn't work out. They wouldn't give him his money back for whatever he wanted. And I still remember him saying, he said to the shop assistant, "Well, you're looking at a very disappointed man." And the shop assistant replied, "I can see that." And there was this sort of weird thing that completed the sort of experience. But as long as my dad could have his crushing disappointment recognized, he was okay with it.
Oh, I see your genetic inheritance now,
yeah, exactly.
Actually. Yeah.
So,
you know, both of these books... wander figuratively, I guess I would say, too, as much as kind of literally from one place to the next, which is that they're both somewhat sort of essayistic and have interesting structures. And I wanted to, this is a sort of a mirror book in some ways to an earlier book of Jeff's travel pieces called Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It. And this is a series of travel essays, which in some ways, you know, had different origins. Some of them were written for magazines, and some of them were, I guess, written for this book. Some of them came from elsewhere. And I was curious, how did you know this was a book rather than, oh, okay, I have 10 travel essays?
Yeah. Well, yes, I was somewhat disappointed by the way that it was continually referred to as a book of essays, because, I mean, I've said this before. I mean, the idea of the travel essay is a sort of tautology anyway, because any essay worth its while is a form of travel. You know, it's this epistemological journey from some kind of curiosity or ignorance towards some kind of knowledge. But also, I mean, the way it was struck, when I had enough pieces, I realized there was, you know, there were numerically enough pieces to make up a book. But also, I was really struck by the presence of certain themes and preoccupations, all this kind of stuff. And then I structured it in a way that I felt, although there's nothing wrong with just a sort of, you know, tipping your essays between covers, and I did that with that one that you published, otherwise known as The Human Condition. I felt this had its own, a proper aesthetic form and unity of its own. So for me, although, as I had to concede at the beginning, some of these pieces have previously appeared, often in very different form. In fact, by the time the book was out, everything in it had appeared in a magazine before. I felt it did have a proper thing as a book, and I felt it was more than a random collection.
Did you have pieces that you didn't include, and why didn't you? What made them not fit?
Oh, yes. There were quite a lot of pieces that I felt were only okay within the original context in which they'd been published, or some of them just didn't fit in with that sort of thematic kind of consistency that was needed. I should say also that when I realized there was enough for a book, then I wrote another couple of pieces which...
for the book.
Specifically for the book, which then it completed the sort of structural arc of the book, I thought.
But then what this book has that, say, the yoga book didn't was this sort of these, I think you were calling them interstitials. I can't remember when we were writing about them. But could you describe that structure and how that came about? And was that baked into the kind of structure of the book, or was that something that you felt needed to pull the pieces together?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. On the one hand, these little bits between the chapters link what's just happened to what's gone before, but also more importantly, the sum total of these little interstitial bits, it provides a sort of a net, really, which binds the whole thing together. I mean, really highlighting some of the major preoccupations of the book.
And Ódni, your book has, has a structure you've given it, which are these sort of diary-like entries, more or less around the calendar, around feast days. And I feel like they give this sort of at least gesture towards structure that allows your kind of riffing inside and to kind of go off into a lot of different areas. So I was curious, partly if you could describe it, like why you picked the feast days. I was curious, like why was that an organizing thing? And then it seems like it goes through, I wasn't sure how many years I meant to count them. Is it 2, 3 years?
I think 2.
2 years, yeah. But if you could, I was curious actually if the book was drawn from diary entries or if that was kind of a fictional organizing force for you.
Yeah, that was fictional.
It is fictional.
So
it's not drawn from diaries or...
No. Yeah. It is, I just wrote it as, I decided to write it as I've written my diaries since I was 11. And then knew about Anne Frank and I thought, I will follow her example, you know. So the structure for it was the ivy, but the structure was also, the subtitle was like the archaeological matrix. So, and it's a lot about my love and my relationship with my brother, and he's an archaeologist. So I was following his, when they are digging into the ground, into ruins, they go through like many layers of time. So I wanted to have the writing, the structure of the book also like that. And the diary is perfect for this. You are just going through many layers. In one day, you can go through many layers. And the feast days, they publish, the university in Iceland publishes every day like a calendar. And I noticed that there are so many like days that bear the names of old Catholic what's called?
Saints,
yeah. And some of them you know, like Saint Francis, but some of them you don't know, and it's so strange that those old dead people are like in the Icelandic almanac somehow. So I was I wanted to get to know them a little bit, those saints, since they were in the almanac, and if they could tell me something about my day. Saint Bridget, she told me a lot of, I mean, she was like the description of the saint of milk breasting women, print machines, like imprints, the descriptions are very poetic actually of those saints. And then I wanted to make like almost like replace them by natural phenomenon and my experience of nature and of my own life, you know. And I
And that's interesting that you want, as you say, it's your experience of your own life. And was this kind of book, which is, you know, clearly loosely autobiographical, but is this, was it, you've written several books in the past, and this is your first to be translated into English, so I don't know the previous work, but was this a new structure approach that you found in this autobiographical mode? I guess we would call it auto-fiction these days, that I think you could both be loosely affiliated with, although Jeff's book was published as not, you know, maybe we can talk about these things that as nonfiction, and yours is published as a novel, but you could sort of equally find fictional and nonfictional elements in each. Is that a mode that you've been interested in, or is that something you've been writing in, or how did you come to this form, and did you start as a writer doing something else, more made up or more nonfictional?
Yeah, I just found it interesting as a form because I met this man in Paris, and he was he had this desire to collect all the autobiographies of rural people, that some manuscripts that had never been published. And I realized that this was my dream also, that to go around Iceland, and especially women. You are so interested in finding the some scripts, you know, hidden scripts in the archives, and they are more and more discovering scripts of women. And there are not many women that wrote their autobiography, so it was also almost like a private joke to publish, you know, I was not important, just 30 years old, and I published an autobiography. Mm-hmm. And it was usually done by famous people, or like famous male politicians before Christmas in Iceland.
Memoirs in the old-fashioned sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this was like, yeah, just writing about nothing a little bit, yeah.
Jeff, you've made a long career of writing about nothing. And, but what's funny is these, I really love his books.
Oh, just bask in the laughter, because yeah, of course I will be getting back at you shortly.
But Jeff, your book comes, you know, it's published as nonfiction, but as, you know, obviously I know, and you've talked about a lot in interviews in the past, a lot of things in your in these nonfiction travel essays are made up or are fictionalized. And you actually, there's a preface to this one, which I feel like is, I don't know if you've been forced to write in the last couple of books, or that you've chosen to write about this, you know, importance of made-upness, the made-up quality in your books. And I was wondering if you could address that and where the preface comes from in this book. And was that something you were asked to write to?
No, that was just something that I thought was worth saying. It's this thing that you're always trying to find a way of determining how the books of, you know, how the book's going to be read, you know. So it was a way of just, this was something that I became absolutely so convinced of, really, that there is this distinction between fiction and non-fiction. Did it happen? Didn't it happen? And, you know, the thing is, I'm actually so on the side of the conservatives in this, in that with certain kinds of books, military history or any kind of history, then yes, they have to be rigorously fact-checked, and, you know, there's no room for maneuver at all. I'm absolutely on the side of the people who object to what I do in that regard. But it seems to me then there are books like mine where really whether it actually happened or not is of so little interest that it really doesn't make any difference to anyone if I make small changes. So it's, and I think, whereas, I mean, I'm always citing him, you know, you read Anthony Beaver's Stalingrad because you want to learn about Stalingrad, but nobody's really reading my stuff because what I happen to get up to in Norway is of any particular, you know, historical relevance, you know, and it's not I'm not under oath, and it's not a legally binding document. So I feel that I'm able to change what really happened in the interest of some sort of aesthetic.
But not in a sort of John DeGatta way that...
Yes, absolutely, because, you know, actually, in recent years, I've found, I mean, that famous exchange that DeGatta turned into a book of his squabbles with the fact checker. You know, I really enjoy the process of fact checking now. But I think one thing that I became so convinced of is that the way that, you know, if you call something non-fiction or fiction, that determines to a great extent how something is read and what the reader's expectations of it are.
So what are, well, and actually I think one of my favorite, I think it was, I can't remember which book of your earlier, one of your earlier books, I think there was a prefatory line that said something like, everything in this book happened, but some of it only happened in my mind.
So what are the
expectations that you expect the reader to bring to this book? Mm. I guess what do you feel like you're promising to the reader?
Well, for example, if you're reading a short story, say, you expect it to behave in a certain way. So, I mean, the book is called White Sands partly because the central piece in it, I think one of the interesting things about that piece is I really think it's very difficult for the reader to know what they're reading. Because on the one hand, it sets up certain short story-like things, but then it doesn't behave as a short story is meant to, because at one point it becomes this essay on Taryn Simon's The Innocence Project. On the other hand, of course, it's not behaving as a traditional piece of an essay on The Innocence Project should. And it really dramatizes that, because the whole thing, it's sort of exemplary, really. So we pick up this hitchhiker.
This is the title lesson.
Yeah, we're on our way back from White Sands. And then just a few moments later, we see this sign. It says, notice, do not pick up hitchhikers, detention facilities in area. And in a way, so that sign is telling you any person you pick up is likely to be a felon of some kind. And in some ways, you know, a thing on the back of the book saying non-fiction or fiction is saying, you know, this is what that person, i.e. that book, is going to be. So I liked the idea of, you know, ideally it would just have a thing on it not saying potential felon or whatever, but it would just say book.
Yeah, I feel strongly about it. And it's funny because I often tell writers who write in this kind of mode that you guys are both writing in that it's kind of the publisher's problem or the bookstore's problem. It shouldn't be a problem for the writer, you know, to decide, you know, what to call it. And, you know, I think in Europe, certainly, there's a tradition of belles lettres, and that's sort of what it is. You know, it's a book. And it's, to me, a lot of these kind of category arguments are outside of what the pleasures of the book are in a way. But I am interested in this, the way that, you know, I think, Audney, for you too, I mean, that you've got these sort of little mini essays buried in this fiction about corporations or land ownership or sustainability or environmentalism. So in this, that it allows you in a fiction to take on these kind of non-fictional topics. And I'm wondering you come from an academic background. Was this a way for you to keep writing on the topics that you were interested in a form that might be read by people? Or?
Yeah, I guess so, a little bit. Like, I feel like because I'm a PhD dropout, so I feel like my thesis is always taking revenge. You know, she's just like squeezing herself into what I'm writing, and I don't want to get her there. I mean, she's so heavy and little bit boring and difficult and written in French, and I was almost like becoming mad of studying. And my mother said that I had, she was excusing me, she said, yeah, Oddný, she overread. It's a term in Iceland for people that are really strange, you know, oh yeah, he overread.
Overread.
Does that exist in American?
I don't think so.
Overread. Overread.
Read over?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
It's like something happens in the brain, you know, and like you have no, So I had to. I guess I will. It will take me a while to recover from this, and this poor book is a victim of that.
And yet, you know, within this sort of non-fiction-y frame of traveling and essaying and all of these things, you have. Your characters go by, you've kind of masked them in a way. You know, your brother you call Owly, and should I put your in quotes? Your brother you call Owly, and the boyfriend in the book is called Birdie. What was that masking doing for you?
Yeah, because I do agree with you. For me, it has never been an interesting question if it's true, or if it's really factual or not, what I was writing, because I'm writing, I'm somehow expressing an experience and an emotional truth somehow, more than anything else. So if I needed to add a little green color here or a little blue, you know, to strengthen the emotional, I would do that. And it was not the question. Like you say, it's nobody cares anyway, you know. But then, again, it is problematic also, because when you are writing about other people. So my brother's name is, in Icelandic, Uggi, meaning what's called fin, a fin of a fish.
A fin. Mm-hmm.
Fin, yeah. So his name is Finn, but then in the book his name is Ugly, so it's almost the same. Yeah, but it was, and that's like an owly. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, it was to protect him so that we could say, no, it's not about him, you know. So because he is attacked in bars often, he's like, oh yeah, you are this guy, your sister is obsessed with you, and she's always writing about you, and she adores you, and you know.
I'm about to get envious of Iceland's literary culture, that can be, that a character in a book can be recognized in a bar, but.
Yeah, so then he can say like, well, it's not about me, it's about this owl man, and yeah.
For both of you, you know, and I think this is maybe true of all travel literature, place seems to be hugely important, as you know, in terms of trying to get a sense of rootedness in place, although it operates slightly differently. And I was at a panel earlier this morning with several Native American writers called Witness and Testimony, and one of the writers was talking about how place is the structuring device of stories rather than chronology or event or anything. And I was interested in that as a concept, that place can structure a story, that the, you know, the dwelling of it in it. And for both of you, I think there's a sense of place and home. I feel like Jeff, in your work, there's always been this tension between kind of leaving England and going outward, but also having this shadow of the place that you come from. Is that a tension that about going away but still trying to reflect back on the place that you came from, that you're mm-hmm. aware of, or that you intentionally write towards, or is that just one endemic to being British?
One of the things I'm struck by in the writing life, that after I wrote my book, The Color of Memory, first novel, after that, I didn't really have that much I wanted to say about Britain. So the books have always been ostensibly about elsewhere, but so many of them have actually, in a way, ended up holding up a mirror to Britain. So the D.H. Lawrence book, which is, you know, it happens, if you like, in so many of the countries that Lawrence, that obsessive wanderer, you know, on his savage pilgrimage, settled in. It ends up being, of course, about Lawrence and therefore Englishness. And the First World War book, of course, is inevitably about England. So, yeah, I think there is that combination of, it's not at all, I'm not going to say anything original now, but it's this weird thing. On the one hand, you're looking out through this window onto the world, but then, of course, that window turns out to be some sort of mirror as well. And goodness knows, I mean, that's something which is been so at the heart, I think, of so many great travel books. You know, I'm struck by something that photographer that we used to know, Michael Ackerman, said. I think it's an extraordinary thing for a photographer to have said. In one of his books, he says, you know, as far as I'm concerned, places don't exist. A place is just my idea of it, which is quite a wild thing for a writer to say. You know, you can think, okay, well, there's a degree of solipsism that is acceptable, but for a photographer, who has that indexical relationship to the world and is, you know, I think it's really radical that.
Well, and that was also the photographer I recall that where we were in a studio and he had this, you were looking at this photo, this incredibly fuzzy face, very indistinct, and you said, oh, how did you get that effect? And he said, that's just what it looked like.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yes, actually, that's right. I'd forgotten that. You know, and then some writers are more reliable in terms of offering a documentary record of what they see through the window. In other cases, you know, it's more a reflection of their of themselves. And Lawrence, I think, is so interesting because it's he, depending on which piece you're reading, it can be a very reliable, astonishingly insightful reaction to a place, as when he lands in Australia, and within a week he's sort of sniffing around. He's saying, yeah, there's something going on here, there's some other dimension. And he says, you know, the white people here, they're not really here, they're just floating. You know, he's intuited the dream time, you know, it's just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Other times though, particularly when he's got sick in a place and he takes against it because he's got sick, then it's really almost valueless as a documentary record, but very interesting just as a picture of the state of mind he's in. So when, after his incredibly brief stay in Sri Lanka, Ceylon as it then was, he gets incredibly sick. And there's this great line in one of his letters. He says, the East, at least the bit of it I've seen so far, seems silly to me. I mean, it's just such a great bit. It's the wonderful expression of some sort of mad Orientalism, you know. But being Lawrence, of course, he won't let it rest. He personalizes everything. So it becomes his experience of the East, as he calls it, becomes this sort of just this battle between him and the Buddha. Because those lovely statues of the reclining Buddha that we all love so much, you know, now, and he just hates these. He says, you know, every time I go into one of these things, I see the reclining Buddha, I just want to say, stand up, stand on your own two feet. So even at his most solipsistic and deranged, I feel there's just some wonderful commentary or reaction to a documentary, some sort of documentary reaction to the world.
I think you'd refer to it as the place where place and self intersect, I think, yes. Is kind of the interesting thing here. And I think for you, Odni, in your book, I mean, there's a different relationship to place, and it's an interesting thread that starts emerging more fully as your book goes on about there's a kind of crisis with your family's land. And so this was a place, you know, you're from a smaller country in the sense of, in a largely rural country, and the sense of connection to the land is a very complex one. And your book gets into these questions of, you know, what it means to own land and what it means to protect the environment, you know, which are really urgent. And I was wondering if you could describe that, well, actually, just that scenario. What was the situation with the family land, and what was the threat? Because I think that was like an interesting story within this financial crisis in the book. But then also, where did you had some ambivalence about this family land and your sense of the connection to the place. Or maybe ambivalence isn't quite the word, but I'll let you.
I guess it's ambivalence. Ambivalence. No, how do you say? Ambivalence.
Ambivalent.
Ambivalent, yeah. Sorry. Yes, I just realized that I had been, or the person in the book, me, I realized that I had been living according to the phrase of the philosopher Heidegger that said, language is the home of the being, which is like very nice. But then I realized that I had been making myself at home in literature and in language and in philosophy and so on, but somehow I had forgot to make my own home. So I had no home, and I was getting a little older, and then I understood that I needed to get a place, you know. So, but then I realized that I was too late. I was too late, because there is no land for sale, you know. And this land that I thought then I could somehow maybe go there, this land of where my father was brought up, and I used to go there with my brother every summer, so it is very strong emotional ties to that land. It's like the earth is my, really, I have to go there. It's very high up on the mountain, it's called On the Mountain. So it's really like you can look at mountains, all there's a circle of mountains, and it's just like built on a wasteland. And I was hoping that they would make this, either I could maybe buy a little part of it, or get a part of it, or because my father was a fostered son, so he did not have any, he doesn't have any piece of that land. So we were thinking if we could buy a little piece of it. But then there was a Chinese, very like a corporation, that would offer so much better. And he was turned down, this Chinese guy. And I had nothing against Chinese people, you know. I didn't even find them silly, but he was a poet and everything. But I did not believe in it. I didn't trust him. When you looked at his record, he was not a nature, you know, he would not maybe respect the nature. And it is so fragile at this place. It's so high up and it's so dry, so it's very fragile. So I thought that he would not be able to. And now it was just bought after I published the book. I was like an activist preventing the brothers of my father, me and my father and our family, we were like fighting against his brothers selling this land to a corporation. You know, we thought it should be sold to the state and being made a national park. And we lost, so it was sold the other day to a British guy that pretends to be a lover of nature, but it turns out he's like a brutal, brutal environmental, that he doesn't care.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
On that happy note, there is this great sense of loss, I think, in Odnia's book too, about this beautiful environment. I kind of want to leave some time for, I think we've got about a little bit of time for some questions here, if anybody has questions. Otherwise, we can keep on talking. But we've got in the fourth row there. And I'll repeat the question, as this is going to be a podcast too. Oh, wait, do we have microphones too? Oh, great. Let's come on up here in the fourth row.
I was going to say a little bit more about the distinction between fiction and nonfiction. That I have to say I'm very struck and surprised by the sort of blitheness with which you skip over that boundary. And I'm wondering if you think that is a recent development in travel writing. Or something that's been all the way there from the beginning, and perhaps those of us who've been reading have not, you know, been sophisticated enough to pick up on. Because I think of early, you know, 19th century, 20th century travel literature, so much of it is about the physical agonies and the logistics of travel. And if those writers were to come out and say, this is all true except for the parts I made up, I wonder whether those accounts would really have any value.
Yeah, I think it's something not just about travel literature, but literature generally. And, you know, yes, it's a very fashionable thing at the moment. But we can keep tracing back the origins of this fashionable moment, and we go further and further back. So I think it was I can't remember which one, either one of those two Orwell pieces, either Shooting an Elephant or a Hanging. First published in an anthology in the 1930s, I believe, and most of the contents of that anthology were of this then newly fashionable molding of or blending of fact and fiction. Okay, so we can push it back to the 1930s quite easily. And then, you know, we could keep doing that until we end up back with Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year, which is not a journal at all. So, yeah, at various times, it seems to me, the distinction has been, or the borders have been more porous than at others. But yeah, it's been, you know, one way or another, people have enjoyed playing with it for a very long while. But I really want to affirm my absolute commitment to the way that, or my sense that certain forms of writing have really have an absolute obligation to be very, very rigorous in their treatment of what happened.
But I'm curious how much it would change your enjoyment of a book if you read like a Paul Theroux book or something, and you found out that if you found out, or you know, Cervidia, you know, the Naipaul book, and you found out, or a Kapuscinski book, certainly, mm-hmm. who made up a lot of things, uh-huh. you know, if that would change your enjoyment of the book. Well, I think that...
Yeah.
Well, I think that's sort of what Jeff was saying, is the expectations are really important, and it's important to honor them.
It's certainly very interesting in Kapuscinski's case, because, of course, now there's all sorts of, you know, things have been revealed. But, you know, Kapuscinski is always saying in his books, oh, I wish I was a fiction writer and I had the freedom to exaggerate, but I'm just a reporter and I'm forced to just tell you. And so, yeah, it's very, I mean, I think Kapuscinski becomes more and more interesting as we learn more and more about the liberties he took. And I think that phrase is quite interesting, the liberties that he took, you know, the freedoms that he stole in a way from... stealing in a way from our expectations of what, you know, you can see where I'm going with that. Yeah.
I think all the way in the back there.
Backing on that, what about the reverse? So if there are essays, I haven't read this book, that are fictionalized or pieces, what would happen if you just said they... Do you feel that you're beholden, if you were to call them a short story collection or a novel, that then you would be beholden to certain criticism or form that those forms take? And I know that you did write a book that I love, the Venice to Varanasi, and called it a novel. So then I was reading it going, yeah, but... the guy's name is Jeff with a J. And so if you could talk about that in reverse, and why wouldn't you just make it a short story or a fictional account? I'm just very curious.
Oh, well, you know, some of the pieces in this book were first published in the fiction pages of magazines. So the title story, White Sands, was published in Granta.
As a short story.
The story Forbidden City, that was published in Harper's as fiction, originally in the third person, then I changed it to the first. And going back to that novel, it really is a novel, Jeff in Venice, that thing of calling that slight difference between Jeff with a G, my name, and Jeff with a J, the narrator's name, is really, that really like flashes up in huge neon letters. This is fiction. I mean, it's really displaying that.
So you didn't transform into a monkey in actual life.
No, I didn't quite enjoy it. But I think it's this thing that, you know, to... I keep coming back now, because I've got this book coming out about him next year, you know, about Gary Winogrand, the photographer, who said so many clever things. And he said, you know, the trick with a photograph is always to make the photograph more interesting than the thing that it depicts. And I feel that's true for me, in a way that, again, you know, somebody writing history doesn't have that obligation. And, you know, bear in mind that for Winogrand, it really is an obligation.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. I just wanted to say, I think today, when we are confronted with such a lie on our political reality, that we are, of course, we want to know if it's a lie, truth or a lie, or if it's fictional. And as you say, and even though we want to play with the gender, like we want to be a nightmare to the bookseller, you know, he doesn't know on which table to put it. It's like a game. But on the other hand, you do not want to compromise with the truth telling in, for example, in politics and in like, and it's like you have to. So I refer to my beloved Hannah Arendt. She said, like, we have to tell the story. We have to be able always to tell our stories and to remember what happened to us, and somehow have this so that we have the so we can trust. That we keep the way to the past and to what happened to us, all that that it's open, so we can go there. But it's like the wasteland. It doesn't mean that you are always going there and you have to have it all right. But you don't want to spill the space. And I don't think by writing books that are non-fictional/fictional, I don't think that's a lie or something. It's somehow, but I haven't quite understood this, but I understand it's very important for us today to understand what is like truth. What is what is it telling the truth, and what we really need? We need the truth somehow.
It's funny how, you know, for certainly much of my early life, think, you know, relativity and you know, the realizing that everything was subjective was so important, and how much that's backfired on us. Okay, let's take. I think we can have at least one more question. Just all the way in the front here. Wait. If you could just wait for the microphone so everybody can hear you and the podcast can hear you.
So I would really go for the truth, especially in the story of you in Norway. If the dog sled didn't overturn, you know, if your wife didn't go down, I know you changed your name. But also, if you had made up that all of a sudden at that moment, the northern lights appeared in the sky and it made everything worthwhile. You know, I think that you told the truth in that story, and I believe all that happened, but if it had been made up, I think I would have felt a little ripped off, and I think I would have suspected, too.
Oh, no.
Well, actually, the story took place at Lake Victoria.
This is the great thing that I feel so, the important thing doing the kind of stuff that I do, all that matters really is that you can't see the joins, where it goes from one thing to the other. And I'll bet you $10, well, actually, there's no way you'd take this bet because you couldn't possibly win, that you can't tell where the bits that are made up and... but here's an example. Another example. In one of the stories in yoga, there's this bit where we go to Amsterdam and we get wildly stoned, and I go into the restroom to change my trousers, and anyway, I get into a right old muddle in the restroom, let's say. And, you know, young stoner kids love this story. It's so funny, you know. And then, although normally I refuse to say whether something did or did not happen, then I sort of say, actually, the truth is that thing that about in the toilet, that never happened to me. That was just a story that somebody, anecdote somebody told me about something that happened to them in a porta potty in Glastonbury. And it was funny. I mean, they felt really disappointed because they thought, oh, God, he's just this, he is what he looks like. He's this middle-aged, boring guy. He's not the young stoner kid. But the crucial thing is that, you know, I could really, I guarantee you couldn't tell when it moved from an authentic documentary record of what my friends and I were doing in Amsterdam to fiction, the best kind of fiction, actually, I just stole somebody else's stuff. So, you don't worry, you wouldn't feel let down, you really wouldn't, because you wouldn't know that you'd been conned.
The truth is that when you go on those dog sled, with a tour operator, you always, you know, the dogs take off. It was just like what you said. And the first thing you do is you overturn and try to dig yourself out of the snow. And the second thing is you're up there at 3 a.m. in the freezing cold, and the chances of seeing the northern lights are quite slim.
Slim, yeah.
That's right.
So
that's true of a couple of the things where actually the advertised of it was true of the Lightning Fields piece, which I was able to join you on, and that you never really see the lightning,
Also, I wouldn't know because I've never been on a dog sledding trip.
Yeah. on that note, I think we're out of time. I'd like to thank these two authors from these North Atlantic island nations.
Thanks to Ethan Mazowski.
And they will be signing books here for you. Thank you all for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.